Welcome to On The Pulse. This week, unfortunately, Fleur can't make it because she's panicking about her masters, but we decided to make virtue out of this and invite a very special co-host on to host this episode with us, if you'd like to introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sam, and yeah, I'm very, 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 very privileged to be here hosting with Hayden today.
Yeah, so Sam's a government student.
Yes.
And interested in sort of constitutional politics.
Yeah, I'm a third year, and the British side of things is what I'm really interested in. Apologies if I sound a bit odd today. After a night out on Saturday, I was sat on a tube with my McDonald's on the way home. God bless the night tube. And one of my two hamburgers fell off the leg that I was balancing it on, onto the floor of the tube. And much like the infamous pizza rat, I picked it up and put it back together again and ate it.
That's so disgusting.
And I think it might have contributed to the cold that I'm currently under feeling today. But anyway, hopefully we will be able to have a good discussion about all things British politics.
I mean, that sort of segues very neatly. Speaking of sort of eating horrible diseased scraps off the floor, Brexit. So, yeah, we've seen in a couple of ways in the past few weeks and months, Brexit's really pushed our party system and our constitution to its like logical limits, right? So we've had the independent groups spring up as an anti-Brexit party. We've had debates over whether they should call by-elections or whether they should remain in the House of Commons, and that sort of questioning whether an MP's mandate comes from the constituency or from the party. We've had the realignment from Brexit sort of challenge the two-party system and the sort of electoral coalitions that they can build. And of course, this idea that Brexit is of the will of the people, which it comes in pretty stark contrast with the traditional idea of parliamentary sovereignty.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that last the last thing that you said has been pushed by everyone's favourite sort of constitutional theorist, Vernon Bogdanow, in his new book. But I think the history of sort of by-elections and when MPs become independent is interesting and, like, instructive, really. So the most famous sort of centrist splitting off the SDP, of the four sort of the gang of four, two of them weren't actually MPs at the time anyway. Shirley Williams had lost her seat in the 79 election, and Roy Jenkins had been president of the European Commission. But both Rogers and David Owens didn't resign the seats that they held in the House of Commons when they split from the Labour Party, and neither did a lot of the others, or I think all of the others that went with them, in fact. So certainly, if we're using that example, there's little historical precedent there, but then you've also got the example of Douglas Carswell and Mark Reckless in 2014, both of whom resigned and fought by-elections and won. So I guess the difference being that maybe the Tiggers today don't think that they would win by-elections. And the SDP, certainly. Shirley Williams, I think, lost her seat in 1983 at the general election. Can't remember if David Owen did. But I think that's probably a lot of what's going on in their heads.
Well, what was interesting about Mark Reckless is that when he was an MP, he obviously stood for the by-election and then in the succeeding election lost.
Yeah.
Later on, he went into the Welsh Assembly as a list assembly member, I believe.
Okay.
So elected as a UKIP AM rather than a constituency one. And lo and behold, when he resigned his UKIP membership and joined the Conservative Party,
I didn't know he'd switched like that.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But curiously, despite the fact that as an MP he's got a greater sort of constitutional precedent for being, I am an MP with no party, so I don't need to call a by-election.
Yeah.
When he was elected in one of the many electoral systems that the UK has that is actually proportional and actually party-based, he decided that that doesn't really matter.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, so
a really different way of looking at it. I also didn't know he'd gone back to the Tory party. That's hilarious. But yeah, I just think it's really interesting because then also you've got all the suspensions from Labour that have been so far in this Parliament.
We've got Jared O'Mara,
Ivan Lewis, John Woodcock, Fiona Lasagna, none of whom have called by elections.
Despite one of them literally going to jail.
Literally. She's out of jail now, though. Yes, and her appeal is being heard today. Her appeal against her conviction is being heard today. And none of those have called by-elections. And interestingly, I don't think the Labour Party called for by-elections for some of them, which is potentially interesting.
Chris Williamson as well being suspended.
Well, Lord knows.
And him being a big proponent of the TIG calling by-elections and him himself not doing it. Yeah. It seems to be that MPs and even AMs and sort of devolve, everyone across the UK sort of political structures seem to be very confused about exactly what they want the constitution to do or to be.
I think so, and I think part of the issue really is that it is being used as a political sort of tool, really, rather than something that everyone agrees on what should be happening. And I think that is one of the big things about the British constitution. Is that it's built on these sort of informal agreements of what should happen in the event of certain things occurring. All the way back in the 1870s, Gladstone said, "The British Constitution presumes more boldly than any other the good faith of those who work it." And I think that any good faith in British politics has died 1,000 deaths thanks to Brexit in all sorts of different areas. So
yeah, this is something really interesting. It's something that I value for the fact that it is an extraordinarily flexible system, and that when we come up against political hardship, like it can change to suit that. It's obviously not really doing that very well at the moment. So I'm wondering if sort of the idea of having good faith in British politics and the idea that the great benefit of the British constitution is that it can morph and change with the times, and it doesn't seem to be doing that very well. Do you think that we should have an actual written constitution, a rule book, so that no one can misinterpret this for party political aims?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, I think there's certainly more of an argument for it at the moment than there has been at any other time, because everything seems to be being undermined, like the role of the speaker and the importance of different conventions that governed the relationship between various different bodies. I personally am still a bit more of a small C conservative in that I don't think so. In terms of a written constitution, I think if we are going to have one, then we need to all sit down and say, do you know what? Everything has to be ripped up. There's no way really that I think we would be able to morph something that has taken 400 years to evolve and continue that morph into a new constitution. It would have to be something, I think, brand new. And I think it would be a shame if we lost certain aspects. I don't really.
Black rod.
Yeah, I don't know, stuff like that. I'm trying to think what we would lose, really. But I don't know, it'd make my life a lot less interesting if there was all set down a rule book. I wouldn't get to see arguments about Erskine May on Twitter and that sort of jazz.
But I'm interested because, like you say, the argument for it now is probably greater than ever. I know that Gordon Brown wanted to sort of codify sort of British values and the British identity in a sort of constitution, and that's what made it so hard for him to ever get round to some proper constitutional reform or codifying a constitution or something like that. But with the evolution of this new party, the TIG, the independent group, are a centrist outfit, mostly of Labour MPs, but with some Conservative MPs. And I know that, at least in British political tradition, this sort of radical centrist, if you want to put it like that, these parties generally are very pro-constitutional reform. If you look at the Lib Dems proposing Lords reform, proposing
electoral reform.
Yeah, electoral reform. Obviously, that wasn't really borne out with the AV referendum.
Yeah.
But I do actually remember Chuka being in that referendum campaign and supporting
AV. Oh, did he support AV? Interesting.
As did Ed Miliband, to be fair. and that never really was in the Labour manifesto proper in 2015. But
interesting.
I'm curious, do you think that when the TIG have an actual functioning policy platform, do you think constitutional reform is going to be at the centre of it?
Well, I mean, you would imagine electoral reform will be, quite simply because they will probably all lose their seats if there isn't some form of proportional representation. And apart from maybe a couple of them, but I don't know about that, if they've got strong enough constituency support. I don't know about the rest of them, though. I mean, I don't think any of the... I don't know the individual MPs' policy positions well enough, but I would doubt that the three Tories are in favour of an elected House of Lords. I don't think there's really any much support for that at all on the Tory benches. I don't know about the Labour MPs, actually. But I don't think the arguments for... Personally, I don't think the arguments for an elected House of Lords are as strong as people think they are anyway, so I think it would... Yeah, I don't know. And I don't know how much of an appetite there is for like extensive constitutional reform in UK politics. I don't know that it's particularly an issue that people care about particularly. I don't think House of Lords reform doesn't come anywhere near the top of anyone's, unsurprisingly, come anywhere near the top of anyone's sort of priority list when you look at what people are interested in. And so I'm not really sure whether they would,
I mean, in parties specifically, and with in sort of parliamentary parties, it always feels for most that it's a second order issue, right? Especially with Labour and the Tories, is that you've got your policy platform, and then a lot of the constitutional stuff like electoral reform is really there to sort of bolster your policies. So like the Lib Dems have constitutional reform as a centre of their platform, simply because in many ways, they can't get elected and can't implement policy without it. Yeah. Whereas, the Tories have been firmly against electoral reform, mostly because the current system benefits them most. Yeah. And Labour's been pretty agnostic on the whole thing. I think probably in principle, it's generally in favour. A lot of the MPs seem to come from that sort of progressive style of sort of modern new politics. But if that ever gets in the way of funding the NHS or the education system, or redistributing wealth, or funding a welfare system, it feels like that's really the limit to what MPs are willing to do.
And I think it would have to come as part of a wholesale package of constitutional reform, I think, that helped us deal with situations where majorities in the House of Commons would be fluid, and as we see today, where the government, where with the Cooper-Letwin idea of backbenchers coming together to pass their own like act of parliament, which we have private members' bills, but those usually come through with the support of the government, and so there's all sorts of constitutional questions about the possibility of that, of how that might happen. So, for example, with Cooper-Letwin, there was a number of people that were saying that... So the bill would go through Parliament and it would pass through the Commons and the Lords, probably, because there's pro-EU majorities in both of them. But there were some people that said the government could use the power of royal assent. So the idea that, the Queen signs legislation. And the principle is, the convention is, that if it's passed through the House of Commons and the House of Lords, then it is signed by the Queen into law. However, technically, it is still a prerogative power that is controlled by the executive. So there are some people that said, even if Cooper-Letwin passed through Parliament, the government could say, no, we don't think that the Queen should give royal assent to it, and therefore the bill wouldn't come into law. And everyone was like, this never happened before.
Good faith, if ever.
Well, precisely. It's never happened before because these sort of fluid majorities, these different... It's never happened that there's been this sort of coalition that can act so blatantly against what the government wants before. And so if you were to have electoral reform, which would probably make majorities even more sort of difficult to reach in the House of Commons, I think it would need proper constitutional reform to come with it.
Yeah. So I guess we've explored two aspects of this. One being a new party group and how they're going to sort of challenge the electoral system and the constitutional makeup, and also how you've said with the Cooper-Letwin Amendment, which was to delay our exit from the EU, and how that sort of severed party coalitions and made Labour vote with Tories and Tories vote with Labour as this sort of wider, more fluid coalition, and how this makes, or how this challenges Britain's current constitution. So Fleur is with us in the next section. She spoke to Professor Simon Hicks from the Government Department.
Lucky her.
Over whether, in the face of all of these problems, the British electoral system is fit for purpose.
You know, politics is broken, I think, encapsulates several things. It encapsulates this very wide polarisation we have between the two mainstream parties, a growing disconnect between the public and our politicians, a disillusionment with political parties, declining party membership, growing electoral volatility. So, you know, people feeling like there isn't a party that they really want to vote for. They're voting for the least worst option in a way. That's not what democracy is meant to be about. So, but the problem, of course, is the winners don't change the rules. So, you know, if a party wins a majority in the House of Commons, they're not going to say, let's reform the electoral system. Because if they reform the electoral system that introduces, say, a more of an element of PR or a more proportional system, it means they won't have a majority. So the only way you're going to get electoral reform is if a party goes into election committed to introducing electoral reform, not just, you know, we'll discuss it and have a referendum, but committed to introducing it. Perhaps a convention that leads to reform of the British Constitution, a people's convention, the way that it's been done in Ireland or other places in Europe. The Netherlands had a citizens' convention to discuss electoral reform in Holland. But at the end of the day, we'd probably have to have a referendum. And referendums aren't particularly popular right now in the UK.
Yeah, so I was thinking some people see Brexit as this great example of how a two-party system doesn't track preferences of the population. In the end, Brexit cuts across all the divides politically. Might the fact that Brexit produces only losers and no winner takes anything be maybe an incentive to talk about electoral reform, even for the Conservative Party and for Labour?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting that I think you're right in that Brexit is a real shock for the established system of democracy in the UK. And we're in the middle of that shock. And once we have left the EU, I think then the question becomes, what are we now going to do with this country? How are we going to rebuild these institutions? I think there is going to be more of a constitutional debate about the UK and UK politics. Within that, lots of it, I don't think reforming the electoral system for the House of Commons is going to be the number one issue. I think there will be issues like decentralising power to local government, city regions. And within that, there'll be questions about how we elect local government. So already we use a single transferable vote to elect local government in Scotland and in Northern Ireland. There's pressure to introduce that in Wales. What if they introduced PR for electing local government in England? I think this would change. And you can make a case that even the Conservatives might be in favour of this, because the way we elect local government in England with the same system we use for Westminster means in large parts of the south of England, we have no Labour councillors, even though they're getting 20 or 30% of the vote. And in many cities in northern England, we have no Conservative councillors, despite them getting 20 or 30% of the vote. So in a sense, it's hard to make a case. Why would you keep the system we currently have for local government? If we are going to decentralise power down and we want people to engage more with local government and what they do, why not introduce PR? And then you're going to get Conservatives elected into city councils in the north of England, and you're going to get Labour elected into rural areas in the south of England, which is much more representative of actually what the voters want in those different parts of the country. So I can see there being much more of a debate about PR in local government in England and Wales before we have a real debate about whether we have it for the House of Commons. There'll also, I think, be a debate about the House of Lords. We were very close with the coalition government of Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives, about having reform in the House of Lords and having elected House of Lords. It fell apart because they fell apart over the deal for redesigning the constituencies for the House of Commons and PR for the House of Commons. But I think it's going to come back. People are going to say, what do we want the House of Lords to be? Do we want part of this at least to be a citizens' assembly, appointed perhaps randomly, or how do we want it elected? I think there's going to be some interesting debates there about reforming the House of Lords that will again relate to this question of changing the voting system.
In terms of the current development with the independent group, which it is expected to become an actual party soon, is there any chance of them surviving under the current conditions, or will they end up like previous attempts like the SDP ended up?
Yeah, so on the one hand you can say this is just like the SDP, it's a breakaway from Labour, they formed a new centrist group, the SDP was a failure because they didn't replace Labour, they ended up merging with the Liberals, and then they've eroded. Or you could say they were successful indirectly because they led to moderation of Labour. We wouldn't have had Tony Blair had we not had the SDP. Another hand, you say the SDP was far more significant because this was a new political party. There were big beasts from Labour that led this. They had a clear ideological position. They weren't just a group of individuals. So in that sense, this is not as significant. A, it's not as significant as the SDP, and if it was as significant as the SDP, it's only going to end in the same failure. On the other hand, the world is very different now than it was in the early 1980s, in that voters are far more volatile than they were back then. The media landscape is very, very different. People engage with politics in a very different way. You don't need to have a mass party membership base to fight an election campaign. You know, you can you've got young people willing to be engaged in politics with social media. It's much more about the individual of the politician rather than the party as a movement. People know far more and can recognise far more individual politicians, and the average person can say, oh, Anna Sobre, Luciana Berger, Chukwuemeka. I mean, even though they may not be big name politicians as big leaders, people know who they are because of the way that the media works these days. And so in that sense, it's much more fluid now. There's much more fluidity with people who vote, who are used to voting for different parties in different elections. We've got local elections, European elections, mayor elections, you know, London Assembly elections, Scottish elections, Welsh elections, and the national elections. And so people are used to voting for different parties. Many, many more people in Britain now split ticket vote across elections. Mm-hmm. It used to be people just voting the party line, and SDP were trying to break the mould. Well, the mold's already broken. So there's much more fluidity, and I think so. There's much more uncertainty. So if they did form as a political party, they would need actually, I think, local councillors up and down the country also to want to leave Labour and join them, which may or may not happen. Then I think we might see some things change quite quickly.
Okay, so you discussed the potential benefits of the current system, which don't really materialise very much. The benefits of the system like it is in the Netherlands, for instance, with proportional representation, how significant are they and what are the major drawbacks?
So you've given me the complete polar opposite of first past the post. And you can think of PR and majoritarians as a continuum rather than a dichotomy. So on the one end, you've got a British first past the post. At the other end, you've got a Dutch. We elect 150 people in one single national constituency. And in the middle are a lot of systems where you've got relatively small regional constituencies, like in Sweden or in Belgium or in Denmark or in Spain or in Chile or now in Tunisia or, you know, large parts of the world. In a sense, it's proportional representation, but it's in relatively small districts where you're electing 4 to 8 people in a constituency, which prevents party system fragmentation. So part of the problem we've got in the Netherlands is you've got 150, you've now got no party with more than 20% of the vote, you've got massive fragmentation of the vote, you then have to try and form a government, which inevitably becomes 3 or 4 parties having to form a government. When voters are voting, they say, yes, a hugely representative parliament, that's great. I have no idea who the government's going to be. And I have no idea how I'm going to hold those people to account afterwards. And when they're sitting around the cabinet table, they can all blame each other for unpopular things. And I have no idea who's responsible for anything, right? So my sister lives in the Netherlands. So. But in the middle, you actually have a sweet spot, which is where you get systems where you've got a relatively small number of parties in the government and a highly representative parliament. And it's because when you have relatively small multi-member constituencies, say you're electing 4 people in a constituency, there's really only 5 competitive parties. you've got to win 20% of the vote in a constituency to get a seat. Whereas that prevents fragmentation. That prevents parties splitting, and it prevents voters fragmenting in their vote. They coordinate around the bigger parties. So you get more representation, you get more pluralism, you get a few seats won by Greens. Yes, you do get more seats run by populist, nationalist, right-wingers, and you get a, but you get a fairer representation of the preferences of the public. But you don't get the Animal Rights Party and the Pensioners Party and the Denk, the what are the Immigrants Party and the every other party under the sun party. I mean, you know, in the problem with electing 150 people in one single national district is you only need 151th of the vote to win a seat, which is a tiny, tiny percentage. So, you know, you and a few friends can set up a party over a weekend in November and get elected.
I don't think I'll try.
Call it the LSE Students Party. There's enough LSE alumni in the Netherlands, probably for you to win a seat.
There have been attempts for a student party, which there's also the 50 plus party.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's, it is definitely problematic in itself too.
And there's what, there's the Animals Party, the 50 plus party, the Denk, which is largely an immigrants party.
Forum for Democracy.
Yeah, the new populist party. Yeah. There's several populist parties now.
Yes. Yeah, and there's, I'm not sure if there's still independent people who left their parties and continued as independent members. There used to be quite some.
Yeah,
because they fell out within the populist
parties.
That's
right, and so you get this huge fragmentation. So you know, what people say, what people like about PR is the how representative it is.
Yeah.
And how responsive it is to voters in terms of, you know, voters' preferences are changing, societies become more plural, and then new parties form. What people like about First Past the Post is the sort of stability of government and the clarity of responsibility that gives you. Somebody's a clear winner, they form a government, and we can hold them to account. We can see, did they deliver or not, and we'll punish them at the next election if they don't. So, you know, that. So if the First Past the Post fails to deliver on that, definitely doesn't deliver on representation, but you can... You don't have to have a system that gives you representation with that level of fragmentation. You don't need that much fragmentation for you to have better quality representation than First Past the Post. I mean, where there's most voters in the UK do not vote for the person that represents them in the House of Commons. And in a sense, they're throwing away their votes. You know, these are people voting Labour, Lib Dem, Green, SNP or whatever, in places where it's a Conservative elected, or people voting Conservative, Lib Dem, Green or UKIP in places where Labour are getting elected. I mean, this is many, many, many people in the country are feeling, I don't feel represented by this system. So I don't think I've ever, in the various places I've lived in the UK, I don't think I've ever voted for the person who got elected. So I'm completely unrepresented in the British system.
So is it fair to conclude that both extreme ends of that spectrum that you talk about basically fail when it comes to giving politicians a mandate? Because on the one hand, there's people elected that have a minority of votes. And on the other hand, there's such a strict representation that mandates blur because there have to be a coalition and responsibilities become very vague.
Exactly. That's
right. So in between, there must be some system that is clear about...
Well, that's what people have tried to do. Electoral system designers tried to design systems... So nobody chooses the Dutch system anymore, and nobody chooses the British system anymore. When you get new democracies, they think, you know, so for Tunisia, for example, was the only country that emerged from the Arab Spring as a democracy, and they designed an electoral system with relatively small districts, a bit like Denmark. So, you know, there's some bigger ones where the cities are, but in the rural areas, they've got relatively small. So some places, they've got single-member districts, some two, some three, some four, all the way up to 10 is the largest in Tunis. And so this is... So they didn't say, let's have the full national... Because that would have been a massive explosion of fragmentation of 100 different parties. So let's keep the lid on it. They've ended up with about 4 or 5 major parties, and then they've got a two-party government. They formed a coalition. So, you know, it's not a single-party government, but two is definitely better than 4 or 5 sitting around a cabinet table.
Yeah.
It's much easier to see who's responsible, to hold them to account, and to think, and so there's, and for them to feel there's more of a sense of a mandate.
Mm.
That's everything this week. I've been Hayden.
I've been Sam. Thank you very much, Hayden, for having me.
No worries at all. Thanks for coming on. This has been On The Pulse. You can find us on SoundCloud, Mixcloud, Apple, Spotify. And we have a couple more podcasts coming up, not just On The Pulse, but we have When Harry Met Saudi, which is a beginner's guide to Saudi Arabian politics, and a couple more ones coming up in the near future. So thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye, guys.